From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Antioch, California.
Potter's Creek.
Pleasant Hill.
I live in Albany, but Albany doesn't have neighborhoods.
Coming up, we'll ride along with a teen trying to make a dent in San Francisco's homelessness problem.
Everyone eventually may hit a breaking point where there's like, today, I gotta get off the street today. Today's my day.
Then we'll hear how inmates are reaching out to support one another inside San Quentin State Prison.
We don't ask people what they're in for, because that doesn't make a difference to us, okay? I could be talking to a sex offender and not even know him, because it doesn't matter.
And we'll hear what the dean of UC Berkeley's journalism school has to say about the state of the media.
People are basically being spied on, or else they're being given information that's being doctored and engineered.
We're pulling back the curtain today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. When most people are on their way to sleep, San Francisco's Homeless Outreach Team, or SF HOT, is just beginning its graveyard shift. The 24-hour patrol team responds to the immediate needs of the roughly 7,000 homeless people living on the city's streets. Some need blankets or medical attention. There are also issues like noise violations, public urination, or blocking the sidewalk. Other cities may call in police squads or ambulances to address these situations, but those responses can be costly or seen as too punitive. The HOT team provides a lighter touch, and they don't disappear when the crisis is over. They're doing the slow and sustained work of building bridges out of homelessness, one familiar face at a time. KLW's Liza Veal rode along with the HOT team on a recent night.
There are usually only a few points of contact between the world of San Francisco's homeless and the rest of the city. Passers-by do or do not give change. Some residents do or do not face losing their own homes. And then there's the HOT team. They work on the street with people who are homeless every day, like rope ladders the city throws out at night, trying to make a path back.
Knock, knock, anybody home?
Home, in this case, means a tent or tarp. We're under a tangle of freeway overpasses where 101 divides SoMa and becomes 80. I realize I'm here every day. We're underneath my route home.
Your husband's out here with you? Just not here right now?
Yeah, he's
okay,
just
so
here right now.
Sometime this evening, someone's going to roll by with a couple blankets for you, okay?
Okay.
One of the two SF HOT teammates I'm riding with, Kathleen Lee, points up at the overpass. She tells me during this winter's huge storm, many people stuck it out.
Many, many people.
Even though the city organized emergency shelters.
I want gals to say, I'm from Louisiana. I'm used to hurricanes. Bring it. Just bring it.
Tonight, the HOT team is making the rounds, checking in and offering services to each person they meet. Like Jennifer Hans-Williams.
They offered a shelter bed for a woman, but I can't be in shelters because of my borderline personality disorder. I can't be around people. It makes me go panic.
Williams and her husband seem to be in their 30s. They look exhausted. Their big coats are worn out. Williams says, beyond the panic, the other reason she doesn't want to head to a shelter is because she'd be separated from her partner.
My husband and I are both positives, you know, with HIV, so we can't be separated. We have to take our meds every day. He's my baby, and we're healthy because of each other, and if we're not together, he'll go downhill, and I'm not going to let that happen. We'd rather be on the street. We want to go inside, though.
The HOT team offers them gloves and socks, and then we head off along the row of tents and makeshift shelters lining the chain-link fence. People pop their heads out and chat with Lee and her teammate, Scott Prentice. I'm not allowed to record the exchanges because of strict confidentiality policies, so I watch out of earshot.
Anything, or did you ask them specific things?
I offered services that we are able to fulfill right now.
Everything from ponchos to drug rehabilitation, withdrawal help, or shelter beds. What's surprising is how many people say no to all of the above.
If they don't want anything, I'll always tell them to call us, and I'll tell them I will definitely come back and check on them. We're back here all the time.
And did you offer those people shelter?
Oh, yeah. Well, many times. All these people don't want shelter. They have tents.
Yeah, you dry, you look warm.
The rain starts to ease up. Lee tells me the HOT team sees getting their clients into shelter as a first step.
It feels like a more tangible connection to other services possible.
But there are a lot of reasons people would rather stick on the street.
I don't like shelters. I was raped in a shelter in Portland, Oregon. So I try not to go to them.
That's Christopher Posen. He's 23 now.
Been homeless since I was 15.
Posen is baby-faced, but unsmiling. He says surviving on the streets is not just about self-defense. It's also about having people to depend on.
My best friend, he's got a heart of gold. Every single time I've had my backpack stolen, he's the one that's found it. Or found a new one for me.
He thinks his route off the streets will be finding a job.
There's nothing more in the world that I want than to get a steady, real job.
But he says he's been turned away for not having a home address. He manages to find gigs like landscaping, restoring windows.
I'm a glazer. So I've done that.
What if you were going to be homeless for the rest of your life?
I might kill myself if I knew that I would never, ever get off the street. I'd probably kill myself.
This is Bates. Go ahead. 013.
All night long, the HOT team is getting calls from the police department, the fire department, and 311. Like this one, to pick up a guy in the Castro, tripping on hallucinogens.
Oh, there he is. I got him.
Hey, how are you?
The HOT team came. We negotiated on what my name was and my birthday and my dissemi-reality, and the fact that I own Jupiter.
Oh, man, your chariot has arrived.
He follows them to the car, and they head off to a shelter. The night I rode along with the HOT team was not filled with crisis. But what struck me is the stasis, the constant, routinized suffering.
You probably never experienced that. It's really strange. It's a really strange place to be. It's its own kind of slight mental illness because it's kind of electric and tingly. You really are on high alert all the time. It's like your most fearful time, and that's where you stay.
That empathy comes from personal experience. Lee has her own story. For years, she lived in a house in Sacramento with her partner. They had their own business, painting and renovating houses.
And we also had a heroin habit that was decades old. It was our own little secret.
In the economic downturn, their business went under.
We just lost work and we hung on for about 9 months and then ended up with our hound dog and us in our little car. And we were recycling, trying to maintain our habits. And then, of course, when you stick your head in enough trash cans, you're going to get sick. So we got really sick. And then the car blew up at that same time.
The HOT team found them right as they hit rock bottom. They gave her and her partner antibiotics and vouchers for heroin detox.
And now we've both been clean for over 5 years.
Are you still together?
Yeah. Oh, we've been together 31 years. That part's not going to change yet.
They live in the city's depleting stock of SROs, or single-room occupancy buildings. Most of the people the HOT team meets every night, they won't be able to help. They say most are not able to meet them halfway, but
you never know who's going to want it until you engage and ask every single person.
And then someone that doesn't want it for months or years finally just gets sick and tired and will say, okay.
Everyone eventually may hit a breaking point where there's like, today, I got to get off the street today. Today's my day.
SF HOT exists so that when that happens, people don't have to try to do it alone.
Lives change. That's the coolest thing ever. So, look. Here I stand before you. You can be different next year than you are this year if you just walk this way. Just one step today. Just one.
In San Francisco, I'm Liza Veal for Cross Currents.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. We are going to hear another story about people lending a hand to those in need. This one comes from the San Quentin Prison Report.
The San Quentin Prison Report.
SQPR is a media collective of prisoners and volunteers from the community working together to give voice to personal growth, social transformation, and restorative justice.
In January 2014, a man fell to his death from the fifth tier in West Block at San Quentin. Although the coroner hasn't officially declared it a suicide, some inmates believe he jumped to his death. Such deaths are rare, but when they happen, they create shockwaves. Inmates need help with handling the trauma, and that's where Brothers Keepers comes in. It's a suicide prevention and crisis support group that started in 2005, co-founded by an inmate named Dennis Pratt. Reporter Lewis A. Scott has this story.
Dennis Pratt was sentenced to 15 years to life for second-degree murder, and he's been in prison for 34 years. He'll never forget the morning a friend killed himself without warning.
We didn't see no signs of suicide or anything like that, and just all of a sudden he went to breakfast one morning, came back and hung himself with a sheet in his cell. And it caught a bunch of us off guard. It was such a shock to the yard that a bunch of us got together and we said, we got to do something about this. We got to be able to spot individuals who are in a crisis state, who are maybe thinking about committing suicide.
Pratt and his friends started Brothers Keepers, a support group for inmates to talk about their problems and their struggles with suicide.
All right, let's settle down. Let's get ready. We're going to Brothers Keepers is going to fix it and get started here. Jimmy, glad to have you here today.
Thank you very much, Dennis.
Glad that everybody made it today. Mac, glad to have you here. We're going to be talking a bit about suicide prevention and crisis intervention.
Brothers Keepers meet once a week. Pratt and other group leaders meet with inmates one-on-one to help them process the trauma they have experienced prior to coming to prison. Jimmy, who is a member of Brothers Keepers, will share his personal experience with suicide before coming to prison.
That night, as I laid in bed next to my wife, I started to attempt to slice my wrists. For some reason, God must have woke her up that night because, because she rolled over and she said, "What are you doing, honey?" And I said, "I'm going to kill myself."
They also meet in groups to help individuals process trauma that they have experienced while inside prison. Recently, an inmate died when he fell to his death from the fifth tier in West Block. Three inmates that meet with Brothers Keepers members share their versions of what happened, but they choose to remain anonymous.
I'm one of the first ones back while they're still releasing the tiers. That's when I seen the shadow of him falling down, and we heard a slap, a loud slap, bang on the floor, and that's when I started seeing the blood come out of him.
To learn that he had actually, as it was portrayed to me, taken his own life, I frankly couldn't believe it.
The inmates who run Brothers Keepers aren't just good listeners. They are state-certified crisis counselors, thanks to training from BayWAR, Bay Area Women Against Rape.
BayWAR came and became involved and started teaching us how to spot people who are in crisis situations or who may be depressed.
Marcia Blackstock is the executive director of BayWAR, Oakland, California.
I actually started working in prisons in 1988 in Solana with the Victim Offender Reconciliation Group and did on and off work with people in San Quentin. And then in 2005, we were asked to come in and help start a crisis intervention training for some men who are requesting that because of a suicide that happened here in the community.
Sexual assault can cause serious trauma, so part of the inmates' training focuses upon that.
We are also fortunate enough to be able to train them as California State Certified Rape Crisis Counselors so they can get the dual certification or just go for the crisis intervention. So that's really wonderful because then they're certified right here to be able to work with anybody who's been sexually assaulted.
Pratt says that some inmates prefer talking to Brothers Keepers rather than prison officials because what they tell the state can affect their cases.
They are more open to listening to us because they know that we're not writing anything down and it's not going in their file or anything like that. We explore options with them. We help them come up with ideas, and which empowers them.
Pratt says that there's no discrimination when it comes to the people that the Brothers Keepers members counsel. They assist anyone and everyone.
And we don't ask people what they're in for, because that doesn't make a difference to us, okay? I could be talking to a sex offender and not even know it, because it doesn't matter. Our main concern is what are you going through? What do you need? Somebody may have had a family member who passed away, or get a denial at the parole board.
I asked Pratt what it takes to become a member of Brothers Keepers.
Making the commitment to be in the group every week. Maintaining confidentiality. After the training, then you have a 2-year commitment for practicing Brothers Keepers on the yard.
Pratt explains how they spot the inmates who need their help the most.
There are people who threaten to commit suicide, who do show signs and symptoms of being depressed and possible suicidality. And it's those individuals that we can look at and see and talk to and help them to see that there are people out there who care for them, that there are reasons to live, that there's nothing so terrible that we have to take our own life for.
I'm Lewis A. Scott with the San Quentin Prison Report.
The San Quentin Prison Report is a partnership between KALW and the prison that trains inmates to be journalists. A more conventional route to that goal is often journalism school. Here in the Bay Area, we have one of the country's most prestigious, the University of California, Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. It's not cheap. It's over $15,000 a year for California residents and twice that for out-of-state students. And last month, the Board of Regents made it even more expensive, charging an extra $7,500 per year. Ed Wasserman is dean of the J School, and he recommended an even higher fee to teach the wide variety of skills journalists need today. As part of our series on the state of the media, KALW's Ben Trefney asked him exactly why Berkeley needed more money to cover the costs.
Listen, we looked at our numbers and said, we're in deficit now. We can't continue to do this. And so we had been, the Regents had forbidden us. Well, let me just back up a little bit. Just about all of the graduate professional schools at Cal have this supplementary fee. The only ones who didn't were us and the School of Education. There were 15 programs, and 13 of them had these fees and have for some time. Haas, the business school, has a very, very high fee. The law school has a very high fee. And schools, even like the School of Social Work, has a fee of its own. The School of Journalism had never – this had come up in 2010, and the faculty voted it down. They thought it was outrageous to try to add anything to the cost of education at a time when journalism was suffering for want of opportunities. What had happened in the meantime is the state of California had continued to fund the university at one level. Our costs continued to rise. And we were running farther and farther behind with the expectation always we'd find private philanthropy to make up the difference. We're continuing to do that. But, realistically, looking at it, we simply decided that students weren't paying enough. And by the way, a third of that money goes into financial aid.
Well, when you have the realities of financial concerns like you're talking about, I mean, even just to operate the program, it requires a different level of income, essentially, that has to be found someplace. I think that that's actually indicative of journalism on the whole, where to have quality journalism, it's going to require certain resources. But as we said, journalism doesn't pay all that much compared to some of these other fields, like becoming a business person or a lawyer, for example.
No.
And so where do you think that then means journalism is heading at this point as far as being a revenue generator and sustainable enterprise?
I think that's a terrific question. And the answer, unfortunately, is not a very encouraging one, because what I see is the sources of income for journalism, the sources of revenue for journalism are getting increasingly muddied and contaminated by money that's flowing in for something that very much resembles journalism, but is clearly motivated by a desire to get certain messages out. And so you're getting this so-called native advertising. You're getting companies that are generating something that looks very much like journalism and making it available to news organizations as part of their informational flow. but in fact is artfully concealed messages meant to promote the interests of the people doing the providing the money. I think this is a huge problem. You're seeing it really across the board in social media, and you're seeing it increasingly in a flow of messages or things that look like articles and have little tiny disclaimers saying sponsored content, but are styled and presented and designed in order to basically beguile and conceal the nature of the financial support that's behind it. So, in other words, we've got a lot more, I think, corruption, what I would call corruption, of the news process with information that's very much like news and may only be a few degrees off news, but is in fact part of a larger corporate public relations mission that more and more entities in the economy are seeing as a way to supplant traditional public relations, which was giving information to reporters and hoping they make use of it, and going directly to audiences with carefully, engineered messages that look like topical information, look like credible news, but in fact, that's not what they're there for. So I think to answer your question, the nature of the financial support, the most dynamic areas of financial support for the news business are areas where the possibility of corruption is almost irresistible.
So speaking from an ideal perspective then, what would be the solution to that?
I think people have to pay for the information they consume. And let me back up. I think people do pay for the information they consume, but right now they pay in very furtive ways that are concealed. They pay in the price of goods and services, and increasingly they pay with information they are surrendering about themselves and having supposedly consented to it through signing agreements that they haven't read and wouldn't understand if they had read them. So really the model of the internet that's out there now is one where you pay for information with information. You allow people to gather stuff, information about you. In exchange, they give you information that you think you're interested in. So going back to my initial point, I would rather have a nice, clean situation, borrowed from cable TV. You pay a cable bill at the beginning of the month, and for the most part, you're receiving, you would be receiving information, programming and the like. And the money you were paying would be farmed out to the providers of that programming and they'd make money from it. I would like to see a situation where I could pay a monthly bill and get information from people who are not then tracking me and not then helping themselves with information that they inferred from things that I was doing and weren't reading my emails and weren't tracking where I went and what I did when I was there. And maybe have a two-tier model. People who don't mind being tracked get information without paying cash, and people who do mind being tracked aren't tracked, and instead they pay some money at the beginning of the month that goes to the information providers. So I guess what I'm saying, the cleanest model of information flows, cleanest model of news would be one where you pay for it. And in avoiding that, we're entering into all kinds of very, disturbing and problematic relationships in which people are basically being spied on or else they're being given information that's being doctored and engineered in a way to compel their command their attention and their respect and their regard for off-screen actors who are pulling their strings.
Well, I like your solution in a lot of ways, and I think that it really actually speaks to reality. I think that you're talking about something, and from your position within the grad school and dealing with budgets, for example, I mean, you have to deal with realities, and so I'm glad that you're bringing the idea of paying for it up. But the concern that I have, of course, and I'm sure you have this too, is that for people who can't afford then to get that same information or get that same information without giving their own information, that puts them in a pickle.
Yes, it does. But right now we're all in that pickle. And they would have to decide as a consumer matter how important it is that they not be tracked. So the market can do some terrific things. It can't guarantee fairness, but at least it can give people a range of knowing choice. doesn't mean that everybody has the same wherewithal to participate fully in the market, but at least it gives them a range of options. Mm-hmm. And right now, that range of options does not exist.
That was Ed Wasserman, dean of the UC Berkeley Journalism School. He spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney as part of our series on the state of the media. And that's just part of their conversation. They also discuss the ways in which social media is transforming journalism and recent attacks on media makers around the world.
I felt the kind of sadness about the attacks on Charlie Hebdo that you would feel if you found out that somebody had, killed like Robert Crumb, the great underground newspaper cartoonist of the 60s and 70s. It's kind of like, what?
Hear the rest of the interview online at kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. And if you got thoughts on the state of our media, or there's something you'd like to see us cover, email us at news@kalw.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW, or better yet, just give us a call. The number is 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Olivia Cueva, Lila Day, Sandhya Dirks, Rachel Dornhelm, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Christina Loring, Ted Muldoon, Judy Silber, Stephen Short, and Liza Veal. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. The line producer was Audrey Dilling. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.